Good afternoon. This recorded lecture is a summary of the first 3 weeks of the quarter, so a summary of chapters 32, 33, and 34 in the book, where we're learning what happens in electromagnetism when things are in motion. The main new thing that happens is magnetic fields are created by moving charges. And in turn, this new kind of field, the magnetic field, acts back on charges. They feel a force due to a magnetic field. Both of these effects happen only if the charges are moving. And then there's a third important effect that relates magnetic fields to our old friend, the electric field, a changing B field creates an electric field. If you want to talk about which chapters these are from, the creation of B fields is in chapter 33. The forces on charges due to B fields is in 32. And the creation of new electric fields by magnetic fields is in chapter 34. In this summary, I'm going to skip over a lot of the details and just talk about the fundamental laws of physics we're learning and some very simple and fundamental examples of how they work. So let's first talk about the two mutual effects where moving charges and B fields act on each other. If we have a moving charge, say the magnitude of the charge is Q, and its velocity vector is V, then nearby a magnetic field will be set up. In fact, in principle, everywhere in the whole universe a magnetic field is set up, but it falls off pretty fast as we go far away from the charge. If we're over here at some position trying to measure the newly created magnetic field, here we're going to label our position by a vector R compared to where the charge happens to be at some instant of time. Then the fundamental law of physics says the magnetic field set up is a constant times the charge times the cross product of the velocity and the displacement vector R divided by R cubed. The force overall is proportional to 1 over R squared. We've chosen to write it as involving R over R cubed, just to get the cross products right. There's another way of writing that formula using the basic properties of the cross product. This is just V sine phi over R squared. If phi is the angle between these two vectors, between the velocity of the charge and our displacement from it. In particular, if we're straight ahead of the charge, that angle vanishes, and it says magnetic field vanishes. So it's kind of funny, a moving charge creates a magnetic field, but only if you're off to the side. If you're right where the charge is heading straight at you, you see no magnetic field. We can also talk about many charges in motion. That is, of course, called a current. If we have a piece of wire carrying some current I, remember I is just charge per second, and we need to say how long the wire is and what direction it points in, we'll describe both of those things by some vector L, which is the length of the wire as oriented in space. Actually, let's do this in two steps. At first, we're going to say the piece of wire is a short one. We're going to call the length of this little piece of wire ds, and eventually we're going to add them all up. Once again, there's a displacement vector r to the position where we're trying to measure the magnetic field. And the formula for the little bit of magnetic field due to this little bit of wire is I ds cross r over r cubed. Very much like the formula for the moving charge, except instead of having qv, we have ids. In fact, if you check the units of those two things, they have the same units, so that makes sense too. Oops, there's a vector sign over the ds. Okay, if we have a whole length of wire with many little ds's, all one after the other, each carrying its little current, what we have to do is add all those different contributions up, or we can express that as an integral . We have to do some kind of one-dimensional integral along the wire. And so this formula for a wire is pretty similar to this formula for a single charge. The main difference is the notation, and also just that for a current, which after all consists of many, many different charges in motion, we have to add them all up, or as we're saying here, do an integral, which amounts to the same thing. By the way, there's a sine phi version of this formula, too. We can express this as the integral ds sine phi over r cubed. Where phi is, once again, the angle between the direction of current flow in the wire and our displacement vector out to where we're trying to measure the magnetic field. So fundamental formulas, let's say these are the fundamental formulas for the magnetic field of a single charge in motion. These are the fundamental formulas for a whole current consisting of many, many charges all in motion along a wire. Just in terms of names of things, this one is called the Biot-Savart law. After a couple of French scientists. Okay, that's how magnetic fields get set up by moving charges. This is the content of chapter 33. Once we have a magnetic field set up, we can ask, how does it act back on other moving charges? And that's given by the Lorentz force law. The Lorentz force law says F equals QE. That's the force on some charge due to an electric field, plus QV cross B. That's the new force due to a magnetic field. Notice it's proportional to the speed v of the velocity v of the particle, and so it only acts when the particle is moving, as we've emphasized several times. Just to be clear, let's say that the charge on which the magnetic field is acting is called charge number 2. Charge number 2 might be off here where we're measuring the magnetic field, and so we can say the force on particle number 2 is Q2 times the electric field at that position. We haven't discussed where that comes from, but there could be an electric field. And then Q2 times V2 times B, where V2 is the velocity vector of that second charge. So if we want to complete the whole cycle and say charge number 1 causes some force on charge number 2, it's kind of a complicated formula because we have to put these two things together. There's a Q1 for the first charge and a V, we just call it Q. There's a Q for the first charge and the V for its own velocity, and then a Q2 and a V2. You might be tempted to say, well, we don't need this magnetic field concept. Why don't we just say there's a force between two charges which are mutually in motion? We could describe magnetic effects between moving charges like this as a kind of action at a distance. Later in the course, we'll find where that idea falls through. Namely, it's possible to create electromagnetic waves, which are waves made of electric and magnetic fields and not containing any charges. These electromagnetic waves carry energy, can do work, can do all those things that you expect a real physical thing to do. And therefore, we've known for 150 years or so that the magnetic field and the electric field really are physical things. They're not particles, they're not objects, but they are fields, and they are just as real as particles or objects. And we do need to consider them as fundamental constituents of the universe. So that's why we're emphasizing the role of the magnetic field here, rather than the direct action at a distance of one particle on another. Okay, turning back to our current, our many charges in motion, there is a corresponding law, for reasons of space, let me just move it over here, for the force on a piece of wire. And now let's say there's a piece of wire carrying a current I2. Let me just write the magnetic part here, I'll ignore the electric part. And L2 is the length of that wire, including a vector direction telling which way the wire goes, and then cross B. So the picture here is there's another wire off at position R. Let's say the other wire goes something like this. It's carrying some current I2. It has a displacement vector L2. And due to the magnetic field from wire number one, it feels this force I2 times L2 cross B. In class the week of the 15th, we worked through the magnitude and direction of the force of one wire on another. Remember, in the case of two parallel wires, like currents attract and unlike currents repel. We'll come back to that later. Okay, these are now all the fundamental laws of how moving charges create magnetic fields, be given by a current or by a charge in motion, and the other side of the coin, here's the force acting on a current or a moving charge due to a magnetic field set up in some other way. Now, we've ground through several examples of the use of these formulas for the magnetic field of a current, and they're not too much fun. There's a whole new way of expressing how charges in motion set up magnetic fields. It's called Ampere's law. So let's turn back to basics. And remember one basic way of expressing electrostatics. That's Gauss's law. Gauss's law says you can measure how much charge is inside a closed surface simply by looking at the electric field on the surface and then integrating the electric field over the whole surface. And remember, that's called the electric flux. And from the electric flux, you can get back to the charge inside the surface. That's Gauss's law. Well, there's a law like that in magnetism as well. It's called Ampere's law. And it's sort of the same and sort of different. It's actually simpler in one respect. Rather than having a whole closed surface, as we have to use for Gauss's law, all we need is a one-dimensional loop. So here's Ampere's law. Let's say there's a wire carrying a current I. For instance, the wire might have one of those vectors, big L, but we don't care about that right now. We're actually not going to need it because Ampere's law is so simple. And then what you do is draw a loop around the wire. So the loop encloses the wire. For instance, if the loop is a circle, the wire has to be going through the middle of the circle and not around the outside of the circle. This is an imaginary loop. It doesn't have to be made out of anything. It can just be in your imagination. Or if you needed to be something, you could use a thin nylon thread or something like that. It doesn't have to conduct electricity or anything. And around that loop, we simply integrate the magnetic field. So we do a one-dimensional integral, a line integral, around that loop. And that's the thing that goes into Ampere's law. Ampere's law now says that that line integral of the magnetic field around the loop is equal to mu naught I. Remember, mu naught is just a constant. And I is the current flowing along the wire. So this is the same idea as Gauss's law. You can stand off remotely from some current and tell how much magnetic field is being created by the current by doing this loop integral and using Ampere's law. It can be shown mathematically, if you're really a calculus expert, that Ampere's law here and the Biot-Savart law over here are really mathematically equivalent to each other. You can transform one into the other. Ampere's law is expressed in terms of currents, so we want the Biot-Savart law that is expressed in terms of currents, not the other magnetic field law that is expressed in terms of individual moving charges. Actually, we could do it either way, but let's stick with currents for now. It's not at all obvious. These are very, very different formulas, but in fact, they can be mathematically transformed one into the other. So example of Ampere's law is just the magnetic field of a straight wire. We have a very, very long straight wire carrying a current I. We're standing off a distance d from it, and we want to know what is the magnetic field at our position. We already know the right-hand rule, so we don't need to derive that from Ampere's law. Let's say we already know the right-hand rule saying that if the current is flowing off to the right, then the fingers of my right hand curl in the direction of the magnetic field. So the magnetic field is coming straight out of the board. Now we want to draw an imaginary loop. We're just going to take a circle of radius d around the wire like this. Here I'm trying to draw it in perspective. You're sort of looking sideways at it, and the loop is actually perpendicular to the wire. But we're seeing it in perspective, and there's our distance d. Let's draw another view of the same thing straight on. Here's the wire coming straight at you, and we're going to take a loop which simply goes like that. It's just a circle of radius d around the wire, and we're going to integrate the magnetic field along the loop. Each little step of the loop is a ds, and we have to do this line integral. So we don't need Gauss's law anymore. That was just a motivation, so let's erase that and take the calculation up here. Okay, there's our circle. The integral around the loop is what? Well, it's the magnetic field whatever that is, times ds around the loop. Now, the wire itself has a circular symmetry. It looks the same from any direction, and therefore we expect the magnetic field to be the same in any direction too. And therefore, as we integrate around the loop, the magnetic field is just a constant. And so we can take the constant outside the integral, and all we have to do is integrate ds around the loop. Well, that's just the circumference of the loop. When you integrate ds around a loop, that's just the total circumference, which is 2 pi b, and then we still have our factor of b. Let's go back and get the vector directions right. We said the magnetic field is direction is given by the right-hand rule, which means it goes around in circles like that. And therefore, when we go around our loop, the magnetic field and ds point in the very same direction. So the dot product of two vectors pointing in the same direction is just the scalar product of the magnitudes. So the dot product just didn't do anything. We just had integral b ds. Well, Ampere's law tells us this is all equal to mu naught I. So putting this little calculation together with the mu naught I on the right-hand side of the equation, we conclude 2 pi dB equals mu naught I, or B is equal to mu naught I over 2 pi D. Where, as we said, I is the current flowing down the straight wire, and D is our distance from the wire. So using Ampere's law, we can calculate the magnetic field almost without doing any integrals. We had to do one integral, but the integral turned out to be completely trivial. It just said, what is the total length of the circle? That's called the circumference. Using the Biot-Savart law in class in the week of the 15th, in the week of the 8th, we calculated the magnetic field of a straight wire, and we had to do a kind of hard integral to get that. The integral of involving the square root of r squared plus z squared to the 3 halves power of the denominator or something. So we could do it, or Mathematica can do it, or it's in your table of integrals, but nevertheless, it's harder work. Ampere's law, like Gauss's law, in those cases where you can use it simply, usually enables you to do a calculation in a much simpler way. That's its great advantage. Notice that we had to appeal to the symmetry of the wire here. If the wire had some complicated shape, if it was a zigzag or something, we wouldn't have been able to guess the direction of the magnetic field or argue that it had to be the same all the way around the wire by symmetry. And therefore, the use of Ampere's law is not so simple. Ampere's law is always true, but knowing what goes into the left-hand side can be a little tricky if the geometry is tricky. In cases with simple geometry, like our straight wire, the use is very, very straightforward, however. Just one more example of Ampere's law. We need some space here. Let's erase this calculation here. The week of the 22nd, we talked about the magnetic field inside a coil of wire. You imagine a cylindrical coil of wire with n turns of wire, n loops, and carrying some total current I. And also we need to know what the length L of the solenoid is. You might also want to know what the radius of the solenoid is, but turns out we don't even need to know that, as you'll see. So this is idealized as what's called a solenoid. Which is a bunch of currents going in circular rings all stacked up to make a cylinder. This is clearly almost the same thing as a coil of wire. We want to know the magnetic field, the strength of the magnetic field inside the solenoid. while that current sets up a magnetic field, what is the strength of the field? Well, we're going to use Ampere's law. We take a big loop which runs straight up the middle of the solenoid for one leg, and then in the rest of the leg it just sort of loops around at long distance from the solenoid and comes back. Okay, and we want to use Ampere's law, which has mu naught I, where I is the current through the cylinder, through the solenoid, is integral B dS around the loop. Except we have to stop and think a minute. The current I in Ampere's law is supposed to be the total current flowing through the middle of the loop. In the case of the solenoid, that consists of many, many little rings, in particular n turns of wire, each carrying a current I. And therefore, the total current flowing through the middle of this loop due to all those wires is actually n times I. So that's the one tricky thing we have to get right, not by doing a computation, but by just thinking clearly about what's going on. What's going on is that there's a big loop of imaginary loop that we're using for Ampere's law. There is current flowing through the middle of that loop, and the total current is the number of turns in the coil times the current flowing through each coil. So n times I on the left-hand side. What's the integral around the loop? Well, once again, we expect, and we found by more complicated means, the magnetic field is generally straight up in this picture. In fact, we already computed with some labor the magnetic field of a single circle and calculated the magnetic field right on the axis, and sure enough, it was straight up in this picture, so we'll just assume that's true. If we take the leg of the loop that runs straight up through the solenoid, then once again, B and dS are parallel as vectors, and the dot product doesn't do anything. We just get the magnitudes. So we integrate up the middle of the loop, which we'll call dz, B times dz. How far do we integrate? Well, we integrate over the whole length of the solenoid, which is 0 to L. We can expect, or we've already calculated, in fact, that the magnetic field is pretty much constant inside the cylinder. Not exactly constant, but approximately constant. And therefore, once again, the constant B comes out of the integral, and we just have to integrate 0 to L dz, and that's just the length of the loop. It's a trivial integral. But wait a minute. We didn't close the looplet. What about the whole rest of the loop that loops around and comes back and closes? Well, we can make most of that go very far away from the solenoid, and therefore it's a good approximation to say the rest of that loop is actually zero. We're playing a little fast and loose with the mathematics here, but if we analyze it into more detail, we can justify that. So at the end of the calculation, we just find that the loop integral is B times L, magnetic field that we want to find, times the known length L of the solenoid, and that by Ampere's law is equal to mu naught Ni. And by solving the resulting equation for B, we find that B is mu naught N over L times I. So that is worth remembering as the magnetic field inside a solenoid. And sometimes when we talk about solenoids, we talk about the number of turns per unit length. That would just be big N over L. So if we use little n to stand for big N over L, this formula can also be written as mu naught N I. And that's an equally good formula for the magnetic field inside a solenoid. Okay. So Ampere's law is the same fundamental law of physics as the Biot-Savart law that we talked about. They're just written in different mathematical ways, in fact, very different mathematical ways. You can use either of them to calculate the magnetic field of a given current. The Biot-Savart law always works in principle, but the hard part is you may wind up with an integral you can't do. Ampere's law is always true in principle, but to get practical results from it, you may have to appeal to symmetry, as we've done in the examples that we talked about. In the case of a magnetic field of a wire, we could appeal to a rigorous symmetry, namely space around a wire is circularly symmetric. In the case of solenoid, we kind of waved our hands. We said we kind of expect the magnetic field to be nearly along the axis, and it's approximately constant, and it falls off pretty fast outside the solenoid. All of those steps, we would have to work harder to justify in detail. Nevertheless, they all turn out to be true, and making those approximations, we get, again, a shockingly simple calculation where it's really just algebra. The only integral we have to do is say, what is the length of a straight segment? Integral 0 to L of dz is just the length of this our imaginary loop as it passes through the solenoid. So both of these methods are good. They both can be used to calculate. They have strengths and weaknesses. They're both different expressions of a fundamental law of physics. Okay, we're now turning to a completely different effect. We're turning to chapter 34. The effect is called induction. And once again, it's that a changing something causes something else. In induction, we find that a changing magnetic field creates a new electric field. So last quarter, you learned that electric fields are created by charges. That's Gauss's law or Coulomb's law or whatever. Now we're saying that isn't the only way to create electric fields. Electric fields can be created either by charges in the old-fashioned way or by a magnetic field which changes in time. And this new effect is called induction. It was discovered by Faraday, a British physicist, who, in fact, it was quite an inspiring character. He grew up poor in London in the early 19th century when poor in London was pretty serious. He was fascinated by the physics. He worked his way into a laboratory and started working for free. And he eventually worked himself up and learned how to do things and then invented his own things and became one of the great physicists of the 19th century and discovered a whole new effect in electromagnetism. So, what is the mathematical law of this effect? I've qualified and told you what it is, but what is the mathematical law? Well, we need a flux. We need what's called the magnetic flux of the magnetic field. And that's a little bit like the electric flux that goes into Gauss's law, except it's with a magnetic field. What you do is take an integral over a closed surface or an open surface, either one, and take the integral of the B field over that surface in a two-dimensional surface integral. So for instance, if we're integrating over a piece of the xy plane, we'd be doing some kind of double integral dx dy. That's the surface integral that we do. And then the fine print about vectors is that if you remember, the vector dA tells you which way is the normal to the surface. You can think of dA as being a little piece of surface area, and it has a normal vector attached to it. And dA vector is just the magnitude of the area times the direction of that normal vector. And then similar to the electric flux, we're supposed to take B dot dA in that integral. That defines the magnetic flux crossing a surface. And now what's the law of induction? Well, it says that there's a surface with a magnetic flux through it. By the way, this magnetic flux is usually given the symbol Greek uppercase phi, that letter, and usually it's called phi sub b for the magnetic flux to distinguish it from the electric flux. Then there is induced, that's the word induction that was applied for the first time by Faraday to this effect. There is induced an electric field around the edge of that surface. So if the surface is a big circle, and magnetic flux is all the magnetic field crossing through that circle, then the electric field is measured along the circumference of that circle. So the geometry is a lot like the geometry for Ampere's law. We have a surface with some stuff going through it, namely the magnetic flux in this case, and then there's a loop which bounds that piece of surface. And what is the law of induction? Well, the simplest way to state it is not to look at the electric field itself, but to look at the voltage that electric field causes. So we can attach a voltmeter at some point to the loop. We break the loop, we attach the two leads of the voltmeter to the loop, and we look at the voltage that this effect creates. And the voltage is called the electromotive force, EMF. But just between us, it's the same thing as voltage. And that's usually given the symbol script E, curly E. And you may expect me to say, okay, the EMF, the voltage, is just the flux in the surface or something like that. Not quite. It's the time derivative. So this is saying that the flux has to be changing for an induction effect to exist. The induced electromagnetic force or voltage is proportional to dB dt, and then there's an important and funny minus sign in the equation. So we'll justify that later, but for now let's just say that equation has a minus sign in it, and the minus sign is actually important. So this is Faraday's law of induction. And there's another, perhaps more fundamental way of writing the law. Let me erase these words and write the other way of writing it. The electromotive force, E, is just the integral of the electric field around the loop. So, and once again, we have an imaginary loop, and a lot like the mathematics of Ampere's law, we're doing some loop integral around that loop. And that is equal to our RMS, our EMF. And then on the right-hand side, we have minus the rate of change in the magnetic flux, which, thanks to this formula, can be written as minus time derivative, that is rate of change, of our surface integral of the magnetic field through the middle of the loop. Okay, so in this form, Faraday's law of induction looks kind of like Ampere's law. There's a loop integral on one side of the equation, in this case a loop integral of the electric field. There's some kind of statement about how much stuff goes through the middle of the loop. In this case it's magnetic flux, which can be expressed explicitly as this surface integral. And there's an important minus sign, and there's an important rate of change. None of this works if nothing is changing in time. There's a non-zero effect only if there's a time derivative of this magnetic flux. So the magnetic flux has to be changing in time. Okay, perhaps it's time for a simple example of Faraday's law of induction, and then we'll be done. let's say you have a magnetic field. Let's make it going into the board. But it is present only in a certain region of space. A way of setting this up would have to have a big magnetic pole here, and near the end of the pole there's a magnetic field. But if you go away from the end of the pole, the magnetic field is much smaller, or we'll idealize it just to be zero. So magnetic field going into the board of strength B, and here's our loop. The loop could be any shape, and the law is still true, but just once again, so we can do a simple symmetric calculation, let's take a loop which is a rectangle. Okay. It has some width d and some length l, and there's some magnetic flux that pierces through the middle of the loop. If we can make that magnetic flux change, we'll get magnetic induction, we'll get an EMF around the loop. How are we going to make the flux change? Well, we could turn the B field up or down. But there's another way of doing it, and that's to pull the loop out of the region of magnetic field. As we move the loop, the amount of flux present will change because the loop is leaving the region of field. And that gives our rate of change of magnetic flux. How do we calculate that? Well, let's say the loop is moving at some speed v. We're yanking it out. And at any time, the length of loop left inside the region of field is called x. Okay. And so x decreases as our loop moves outwards. And in fact, dx dt is rate over time, not just our speed v that we said. Okay, so what is the magnetic flux piercing the middle of the loop? Well, we have to integrate in two dimensions where the field is non-zero, but it's a simple integral. Because the magnetic field is constant over part of the loop and zero elsewhere. And so all we have to do is integrate over the part of the rectangular loop where the magnetic field is non-zero. That's a region that's d times x in extent. The magnetic field is constant there. And so we can take it outside the integral. And we just have to do some kind of integral dx dy over that two-dimensional rectangle. Well, that's just the area of that rectangle, which is then b times d times x. So that's the magnetic flux. And is it changing? Yes, it's changing because x is changing, right? We said dx dt is equal to v. So db d phi dt, the rate of change of the flux, is b dv equals, well, I'll just leave it like that, b dv. We cannot use Faraday's law of induction and say the electromagnetic force around the loop is equal to minus d phi dt, which is minus b dv. So there really is a voltage around that loop. We can measure it. We can use it to do useful work. For instance, if the loop is made out of a copper wire, then the voltage on the copper around the copper wire will cause currents to flow in the copper wire. That can be measured. And in fact, we can do useful work that way. Again, we're back to the problem that a single loop doesn't do much. The numbers are kind of small. So what we do is go back to many, many turns. If you have a solenoid of many, many turns moving in a magnetic field, that's an electric generator. So the basic law of induction says there's an effect. And then it's just a question of the engineer is making it better to make a useful device. Okay, so to sum up the last part, there is a whole new way of creating new electric field. It's called induction, And the idea of the law is that a changing magnetic field creates a new electric field. The details of the math are that a loop integral of the electric field, which we call the EMF, or electromotive force, or voltage around the loop, is equal to the rate of change in the magnetic flux through the loop, and then there's an important minus sign, which we discuss in class. Okay, so we've now discussed the main ideas in all three of these chapters, namely magnetic fields cause forces on moving charges create magnetic fields, and if you have a magnetic field which itself changes as time goes on, there's a whole new effect by which new electric field is created. These are now most of the important facts about magnetic fields, electric fields, and charges in motion. When we get done assembling all the important facts and laws about those, we'll be in a position to discuss Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism. And from that follows electromagnetic waves, which are perhaps the most spectacular prediction of the theory. And we'll take those up in subsequent weeks in this course. So that's all for today. There are some notes on the web that go along with this lecture, simply summarizing the main formulas and laws we've talked about. Thank you.